You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly, in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to edition 283 of the Monocle Weekly in association with Persol here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we'll ask whether a medical revolution is underway as one Silicon Valley-based company offers to map your genome for a surprisingly affordable fee. We'll be hearing from Anne Wojcicki of the firm 23andMe.
And... one of the masterpieces of modern jazz is 50 years old this year. We'll speak to two musicians who've reimagined John Coltrane's A Love Supreme.
And he's one of the greats of Colombian literature. Thomas Gonzalez will explain why it's taken more than 30 years for his most famous work, In the Beginning Was the Sea, to be translated into English.
All that and, of course, our look ahead to the stories that are sure to set the news agenda during the week to come, coming up right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Another week bites the dust, Andrew.
Oh, and it bit hard.
Now you've been a busy man. If I'm not mistaken, I saw you fetching up on some kind of US television program at one point.
Yes, the week clenched its teeth around my buttocks and would not let go. I went to New York on Monday. I came back on what day was it? Thursday. I came back and I was on Bloomberg TV. I had a very nice time. Went on a show called The Surveillance, and we talked about the forecast, which I've been banging on about here for week after week. One of the interesting things was when I got to the studios very early in the morning. I think it was like 5 o'clock in the morning. Security guard, and I'd been told to go and collect my pass before I went up to the studios. So I said to the gentleman, "Could I get my pass, please?" And he said, "Sorry?" I said, "I just need to get the pass." "Sorry?" And then he said, "You want a pass? What's a pass?" And then he suddenly realised, you need a pass. You get lost in translation in America
sometimes. It is amazing how that can still happen. Now, one day the Queen's English will make its way over there, I think, Andrew.
Try saying tuna. People think you're saying chicken.
Oh, you know.
Tuna? What?
I have these kind of rows quite often. You should try and ask one of my American colleagues how to say the word duke.
Oh, I know. Well, maybe we'll drag him in later on and to do a little lesson in the Queen's English.
Very good. In fact, why waste any time? Why don't we hear from him next?
And here he is in his cheerleader's outfit, shaking his pom-poms for all to see.
Hello.
That's the voice of Daniel Giacopelli.
It's Duke.
No, you say Duke.
It's D, Tom. We've had this conversation probably once a week in the past 3 years.
And what about a tuna fish?
How would you say TikTok? Would you say yes, chick-chock?
That's the thing. That's a different word, Danny.
Correct. It is a different word, but the same letter.
Mm. Would you say, can you pass me that though?
Would you? I would say pass. Yeah. Well, I'm from New York, so I mean, if you said pass as you do, I would understand you because I've been amongst your kind for quite a while.
And would you go for ass or ass?
Ass. Well, what are the other choices?
No, that's fine.
Excellent. Okay. Right, you just did your own punchline then, Danny. That was quite brilliant. Wonderful. This is a serious part of the show, of course. It's not all hijinks. You're setting our agenda.
No, I can't do anything serious.
Of course you can.
You can.
You're setting our agenda for the week ahead.
Okay.
Where should we begin?
Well, we should begin here at Midori House. It's the Christmas fair, the fourth one I've been at, and I've always been assigned the tombola for some reason, the tombola. I don't know why, though. I've always been given that job.
Well, it's out there
now. I've never
had
anything else.
It's out there now, ready to roll. So, yes, if you're in London today, we're all here. So come down and say hello to us.
You have until 5 p.m. London time.
5 p.m. And, yes, it's lots and lots going on. Chance to get your Christmas gifts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good gifts at the tombola.
Chance to see Santa. And chance to have a tumble with Danny Giacopelli.
All right, moving on. I know we don't really do...
that will raise a pound.
We don't really do celebrity news or royal news at all, but I had to mention this just because Americans love... they love Will and Kate a lot. And they're going to be taking their first trip to New York next week. The first time...
I hope they don't go to Bloomberg. They'd never get in with those accents.
They're going to go to an NBA game. They're going to go to the Met. They're going to kind of walk around and hold hands on Fifth Avenue or something. And Americans just eat that up. My mom loves them, too. So maybe she'll try
now,
to
Now, I know that
up.
Your mother likes to dress...
I don't know. Where are you going?
No, no, no. She likes to dress the family dogs in little outfits, maybe with the royal couple in there. Maybe a little crown, something like that for your dog?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
A ruff?
Oh, that's quite good. Okay. Look, Danny's actually getting a bit nervous. Does your mum listen to the show?
No, she doesn't really know what I do.
Okay.
Let's go to China now.
Let's go.
It's the World Memory Championship taking place on the
7th. Oh, this is good. I like this.
10 different disciplines are conducted over 3 days here, and it's playing cards, binary numbers, random words. Basically, people from 30 countries. There's hundreds of people going. I've given you a few examples, actually, of some of the things they might have to remember. Something like decks of 25 playing cards in a row. They have to memorize every card.
That's tricky. I've been drawn, Danny, can I just interrupt, by one of the winners from last year, the best junior female from Mongolia, was 17-year-old Namuntul Bat-Erdin.
Was the test to memorize how to say her name?
She became a grandmaster at the first ever World Memory Championships.
I'm not quite sure. It sounds a bit un-PC what they call it. Join one over 100 mental athletes.
And it's all done by points, so you get certain points for memorizing certain numbers of things.
This is great. I wonder, who's the best? What's the best nation, Danny? Because it seems quite international. You've got Mongolia here, Danes, Chinese competitors, a couple of Americans,
If I were
Germans.
Going purely by national stereotypes, which I often do, I would say the Chinese would be great at it because they know how to do rote memorization.
I only had one winner from last year, according to this list.
Well, who's out on top?
Thomas Lewis, who plays, is someone from Wales.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, so there we are. That's in China. You know I like auctions. So on the 9th, Sotheby's is auctioning, well, it says arguably the most famous book illustration of the 20th century.
And you like books.
I do. It's Piglet and Pooh of Winnie the Pooh on Pooh Sticks Bridge. So you could buy that if you want. We could put it up in Midori House.
So it's the first edition of the whole thing?
It's
the illustrations for the book.
It's from 1928. It's the illustration. It's one illustration from the book.
Oh, I bet that's going to fetch a pretty penny.
And also the following day, Keith Moon's drum kit is going under the hammer.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of condition is it in?
I dread to think
some of the action that scene really is.
On the 10th, of course, the Nobel Peace Prize awards are handed out. We know who won, but Malala and her co-winner, which... sadly, people don't know his name, even though he's been working tirelessly for decades.
What do you think about that, Danny? Malala, is that a bit, a precocious talent, but too soon perhaps to be recognised by that sort of award?
I'm not going to weigh in on this.
Interesting. Somebody I know very well went to see her speak, and afterwards she had to go literally kind of apparently nip off to go back to school, kind of do her kind of swatting, and just said she was actually an incredible orator, a really amazing speaker, and they kind of went along thinking it would just be interesting to kind of see what she had to say, but said it was actually extraordinary to hear her talk.
Oh, well, I feel
bad. Yeah, everybody says
I feel really bad for making that point now.
You didn't know that I could be nice, did you?
No, that's completely see, wrong.
See, exactly.
Finally, I think we have time for one more. The feast of the Our Lady of Guadalupe, I believe I'm saying that right.
Yeah, that sounds beautiful.
Is happening on the 12th in Mexico. It's one of their most famous cultural events.
I
should throw that in there.
Yeah, what do you get at the feast? That one you've taken off a diary. You don't know what that is, do you?
Well, it's a Roman feast. Catholic feast.
To help our radio listeners, Danny just touched his nose. The surefire telltale sign of the liar.
I know that the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City is the second most visited Roman Catholic shrine in the world.
You literally don't have a clue what happens there.
I have no idea.
Oh, dear. If only your mother was listening now, then she...
She's not very Catholic.
She would be like us, still wondering what you do.
Somehow it all works, though, and I have a job.
Well, thank you very much,
Danny.
For
now, Danny, for now.
From London.
To New York.
To Tokyo.
To Shanghai.
To Berlin.
To Tel Aviv.
To Buenos Aires.
To Toronto.
To Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
A
personal DNA testing kit from the Google-backed genetics business 23andMe launched in Britain earlier this week with the bold promise of revolutionising the way we interact with the medical profession. The firm will charge £125 here for its personal genome service. It provides over 100 reports on health, traits and ancestry.
But the test is not, of course, without its critics. A little earlier this week, Anne Wojcicki, co-founder of 23andMe, came to the Monocle Weekly Studios here at Midori House, and I began by asking her what she thought of the reaction from the British press.
It's actually been quite good. You know, it's been the fact that there's so much enthusiasm, I think, shows the fact that people are interested in their health and they want to be proactive, and people more and more are taking charge of their health information. It's no longer something that you just get from your physician. But when WebMD came out in 2000 and people started going online and getting all this information, I think more and more people are, you know, they want to be proactive and take charge.
I wonder, is there a frustration, though, because, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, operating at, you know, at or close to the cutting edge of science say, well, there's always a reluctance, there's always a reticence about engaging with new ideas or new approaches, perhaps more specifically. Is that a source of frustration? Now, you've had some regulatory issues in the States and elsewhere. Does it threaten to impede your progress?
It's been interesting because I think that there's been a lot of controversy from sort of scientists and physicians, regulators, et cetera. But we really appeal to the consumer. And what's interesting is that, you know, healthcare is shifting from a model where you had this intermediary that was making all the decisions for you to something where you can actually be proactive and you can step up and take ownership. And I think that your genome is probably the most intimate thing about you. And the fact that you actually can now get access to it and then you own it. It's not your physician that owns it. It's not your insurance company that owns it, but you yourself own it. And I think that that's really empowering for people. And I think that's the new generation of health.
Some people understandably are a bit skeptical about the capacity of some businesses to safeguard their personal information, however it's harvested. How do you alleviate people's worries when they talk about this? Because they will presumably say, well, look, it doesn't get much more personal than this with data. How do you sort of appease people's concerns?
So we definitely get that. I mean, I think that privacy is key to 23andMe. You know, we've always said since the beginning is that we don't have a business if we can't do everything we can to protect individuals' privacies. So there's always a risk, but privacy is just, you know, hugely important to us. So we've defined it as privacy is, you know, it's what you want to do. And so if you want to share your information with your friends and family, you can. If you don't want to share it with anyone, you don't. Your information is yours to own. 23andMe, from a database perspective, you know, we looked at how the banking industry organizes all that data, and most people today now bank online. And frankly, it's, if I think about what I want to get access to, your genome or your bank account, most people's bank accounts are probably more interesting. There's a lot of technology that we can learn from the banking industry, and we've applied that to your genome. And we do everything we can to make sure that your genetic information is separated from any kind of personally identifying information. And we really try to keep up on all the technology that we need to in order to ensure your privacy.
And what about in terms of the fundamentals about what the service can offer? Mm-hmm. I mean, people say, well, you know, why do I need to spend my £125 or whatever it will be in different marketplaces? Mm-hmm. What do they get from that, I guess, when we get down to brass tacks? Mm-hmm.
Well, the most fascinating thing is for £125, you get your genome. You know, it's not all of it, but it's, you know, roughly 1 million data points in your DNA. And so, you know, if you think about, you know, in 2000, that was $3 billion. And the fact that you can now get access to it for £125 is pretty remarkable. What you can do is you can explore all about you. So it's not just, you know, I think people traditionally have looked at their genetic information and thought that it was just about health. It is about health. It's about disease risks and drugs that you maybe might have an adverse event to, or things that you might be carrying and passing down to your children. But it's also fun things like traits, like how much are you sensitive to caffeine? Are you a fast metabolizer or a slow metabolizer? Are you likely to like coriander or think it tastes horrible? And there's some of those fun things, like it's kind of that, you know, it's the human element of what makes you you. You know, you have all kinds of different interesting things about you. Are you left-handed, right-handed? Can you roll your tongue? You know, are you double-jointed? And I think that that's also part of what your genetics is. But then it's also your ancestry and where are you from in the world and who are you related to? You know, you and I might be cousins and we just don't know. And then there's other fun things like the Neanderthal score. So how much Neanderthal is in you? And that's one of the things that people love to post on social media and talk about, because it's part of you. It's part of your DNA. And it's something that you can share and it's relatable. And people love it.
the accessibility, I guess, is one of the key strands. In terms of the health applications, though, there has been some scepticism. I mean, there was a quote here from a chief executive from the Centre for Genetics and Society saying, without strong public oversight, we're back to the era of snake oil, talking generally about this area. Is there a risk that there's a perception of that from the public, that it may give me some guidance, but it doesn't actually tell me something that's definitive? Or is it hard to deal with definitives when you're looking at this sort of genomics area?
Genetic information runs the gamut of all different. So there's cystic fibrosis, there's mutations associated with being a carrier for cystic fibrosis. There's mutations associated with, drug response to medication called Plavix, where if you have that mutation, you're unlikely to respond to the medication. There's probably the most well-known mutation, which is the BRCA mutation that Angelina Jolie had, where, you have a very high risk of breast cancer. So there's a lot of that information that is on 23andMe now. But at the same time, we're still learning about the genome. And part of what we want to do is keep people updated with this. And we want to keep them abreast of, new discoveries as they're coming out. So I think that's part of our responsibility, is making sure people understand this is the information that you really take to your physician. This is what's medical and serious. And then this is the information that's new and breaking. And we want to just keep you updated about it, but it's not necessarily actionable yet. 23andMe always tries to be incredibly transparent and to take feedback from the scientific world. And that's actually one of the things we've been working in the UK with scientists here for a long time. So we're very open to getting that feedback. And we want to make sure that we are providing information in a way that people can understand, that is scientifically accurate, and that, has the support of the medical community. And we'll keep iterating when there's feedback where people, if they can give us specific criticism, we're always open to getting that feedback. And, we've been around for 8 years now, and we've been getting lots and lots of feedback. And this UK launch is a reflection of all that feedback that we've gotten over the last 8 years.
So, Anne, if we look a little further ahead then, what do you think the time frame is for looking at, as you mentioned, some of these very specific conditions, diseases that sort of come under the compass of things that you look at when you do your profiling? What's the time frame for actually making real changes to the point where perhaps we can identify, even help to eliminate these things? Are we talking about one generation? Is it still the scale of the task? Mm-hmm. Is it still far too great that, even a company like 23andMe alone can't make that much difference?
Oh, I think 23andMe will make a huge difference. I mean, one of the things that we haven't talked about is the research component. Is, we have 800,000 people who have done 23andMe today. Over 80% of them consented for research. So we ask those individuals regularly to take surveys. And with all that survey information, with the genetic information, we're able to partner with academics and with pharma companies and make new discoveries. With this idea that, instead of actually having a new hypothesis, scientists tend to have a hypothesis every 5 years, and it takes that long to go and actually answer that question. And we can actually almost make research like as simple as running a Google search, is that you just type in a query and you're able to get a response back about, what is the association between caffeine and genetics and Parkinson's disease? And you can run that query and get the data back right away. And that's part of the thing that 23andMe is really trying to revolutionize, is that this pace of discovery. And I think that, we can modernize, we can really change the way we're approaching research. And I think that that will have a massive impact on research and discoveries and treatments in our lifetime.
Well, let me ask you about that pace of change then, because I've seen you speaking before about things, and you've cited examples like in mobile telephony, the cell phones. You have this extraordinary, almost in a single decade, it completely changes people's expectations. It changes the whole landscape. What would it take for this area of, I don't know what you'd call it, whether it's genomics or the sort of participatory nature of it, what would it take for a similar kind of quantum leap to happen, maybe over just a 10-year period? Does that involve governments? Is it other private investment? What would drive that kind of pace of change?
To be honest, the thing that we want, like, we think about, if we have 10 million people actively engaged in research, you can almost answer every type of question. That's one of our goals, is to get to that kind of critical mass where you have all these people who are really actively engaged and getting, thousands and thousands of researchers around the world running queries. And I think that you're going to have an explosion of discoveries. I think for the next 5 or 10 years, you're going to start to see those kinds of discoveries coming out. One of the things that's really interesting that you start to see is that there's these things called these human escapers. So, for instance, in Pakistan, there's these people who don't feel pain. They have a genetic mutation, so they don't feel pain, and they tend to be firewalkers. And there's other people who have a different mutation, that same gene, and they feel tons of pain all the time. So clearly understanding this gene means it's an interesting drug target. And there's actually now a number of pharmaceuticals researching that drug target. And that's one of the types of things that 23andMe is going to be doing more and more with pharma companies, is understanding that kind of, you know, variance in humans, and then saying, let's go and actually try to make really effective drugs based on what we know in the human.
And I'd like to ask you a little bit about how you actually sort of run your business. I've seen you before talking about your former experiences on Wall Street, working on the financial side, and you talked about needing to almost kind of detox from that experience, which I thought was quite striking. Mm-hmm. How do you ensure, with your sort of business hat on, with your CEO's hat on, that you don't ever go down that avenue of, you know, employing people maybe who feel cynical about the objectives of their company, or who are cynical mm-hmm. about the nature of the sort of the capitalist demands on their business? How do you keep people enthused and honest, I guess, in their approach?
Mm-hmm. You know, we are very much of a mission-based company, and people, you know, in Silicon Valley, it's competitive to hire people. And the people that we hire overwhelmingly are there for the mission and really believe in what we're doing. And I think that the mission, you know, the mission about trying to empower the individual and revolutionize healthcare is hard. Frankly, it's a hard path, because we are changing a lot of, you know, the status quo. And so you really only get the people who are passionate about this and love it. And the mission, people are reminded on a daily basis, especially because of our customers, and our customers who write in and say, you changed my life, and, you know, you saved me, you know, found breast cancer early, or you helped me find my mother or my father, or you, you know, helped me get my identity and I understand what my background is. Like, we really change lives, and getting those stories, it's an incredibly rewarding experience. But I think it also keeps people reminded about, like, this is our mission. Like, you know, we're not selling another trinket. We're really intimately impacting people's lives, and people take the job incredibly seriously.
You mentioned that the Silicon Valley background, you're very well, you know, connected. People talk about, you know, Silicon Valley royalty, this kind of thing. Do you find that frustrating? Is that a distraction from the work of your business? Or do you think that in a way it's helpful, because it gives you a chance to say to people, look, you know, there are facets of the Silicon Valley, you know, businesses that are actually a bit misunderstood. Again, maybe because it's often viewed through the prism of a rather skeptical media. Mm-hmm. Is that problematic, do you think, to often get the message across that in a lot of these companies that people think they understand very well are actually doing very different work?
I think the best thing for us to do is we keep, by staying focused on the mission, and I think it's, talk is cheap, and you want to lead by example. So we, for instance, we were recently at the National Institute of Health, and they were asking us, they're like, we show them all the studies that we had done and all the publications we had, and they're like, why did you do this? And we said, well, because this is, like, this is our mission. Like, no one's paying us to do it. No one, you know, we didn't get any government grants to do it. Like, the mission of the company is to do good and to make these discoveries and do research. And so I think that rather than just, you know, Silicon Valley is always going to have its reputation, but you will lead by leading by example and actually having concrete examples that you can say about how you are making a difference in the world. That's how you're going to win over opinions. And that's kind of what I stay focused on. I don't even worry about the outside opinions. I worry about, okay, let's, like, what are we going to do that's really going to have the biggest impact on the world?
And just very briefly, one final thought, looking to the next sort of 12 months or so, what are the most exciting developments that we could be seeing in, certainly within the sort of genomics field, you know, and for your business specifically, what's the things that really, you know, make you think this could be, you know, really exciting time over a year, I don't know, medium term also?
I think that the thing that people should start to expect is that you should never take a medication without knowing if it's going to work for you. And I think that we all suffer from having this experience of taking a medication and not knowing, is there an adverse event or is it going to work? And I think it's not going to happen necessarily in the next 12 months, but I think in the next 5 years, we should have a very good understanding of, like, who's responding, who's not responding. And that alone would have a massive impact on healthcare costs and on patient satisfaction about what, you know, how they're being treated. So I think that you're going to start to see things like that in the near term. And, you know, the genome is being uncovered an incredibly rapid rate. And I think that's part of what 23andMe tries to do, is convey the excitement that we all have to the average individual. So you can say, welcome Trust and National Institute of Health, like, all these groups are coming together and putting billions of dollars of federal funds into all this research, and you should know what it means. And you should know what it means for you. And we're going to understand why, you know, why is it that some people can have stage 4 breast cancer and live for 20 years? So we're going to start to understand those types of things. And I think it's an incredibly exciting time, because we're going to really start to understand disease. But most importantly, we're going to understand health. And how is it that people can live to be 100 and be super healthy? Because, you know, ultimately, that's what we all want.
Anne Wojcicki, co-founder of 23andMe, speaking to me a little earlier.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. Up next, we'll meet the musicians who have brought the jazz maestro John Coltrane's masterpiece, A Love Supreme, back to life. Stay with us.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards. Well, that's an extract from A Love Supreme, John Coltrane's seminal work that, in many eyes, revitalised and revolutionised jazz when it debuted 50 years ago. Well, to mark the anniversary, a group of musicians have joined forces to reimagine the piece half a century on.
And we're delighted to welcome two of those behind the A Love Supreme project to join us right now in the Monocle Weekly studio. Orphy Robinson, a musician and the project's musical director, and Paul Bradshaw, the project's curator. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly. Orphy, perhaps I'll start with you first of all. Andrew sort of mentioned there this idea about this extraordinary piece of work, revolutionary in its time. Does that necessarily mean, I guess, that you approach this project with some trepidation? Because it's almost a kind of a sacred piece in so many ways.
Of course, yes. I mean, my initial thoughts were run away because it is one of those pieces. As a musician, you know, you sort of there are various sort of albums, like say Miles Davis Kind of Blue, that sort of thing, or in other fields, say Marvin Gaye, you know, the What's Going On album, that are just fantastic landmarks, you know, for any musician. But with Love Supreme, there always seemed to be more. It wasn't for me about the notes, or, you know, it was just that he took the music to another place. He sort of, what, you know, transcended that. So that was always the trepidation kind of area where you thought, can I do justice? Can we do justice to this?
And Paul, what does project curator mean in this sense? Are you the person who kind of pulled together all the people, or?
Basically, it was myself and a friend of mine. We had an idea to do a series of concerts, which were to be called Sacred Music in Sacred Spaces. And our initial choice as a piece of sacred music was John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. And the idea was basically, as we said, to re-envisage this project, to re-envisage the music. To do that, we organised a grant from the PRS Foundation and hired Roland Sutherland to rescore the whole piece for 15 musicians as opposed to four.
Can I just ask you, Orphy, when you're grappling with something like this, is it a bit like trying to say to somebody, fancy having a go at repainting the Mona Lisa? You've got this this kind of genius piece of work. Are you kind of setting yourself up for a lot of comments?
Yes, there is quite a lot of that. I mean, I think, you know, having sort of experienced a lot of different music and gone into a lot of areas where I sort of thought, do I really belong in here? Does that, you know, will this work, sort of thing? And then loving that idea of walking the tightrope as well, that's always sort of floated my boat in a big way. Myself, I've sort of reimagined, re-envisioned other artists' work. Thelonious Monk, I did a project called Funk Monk. Duke Ellington, I did Electric Ellington, and an African Miles project, that sort of thing. So I've always
kind of... What was the title of that one? You've got good titles for all these things.
Oh, it was just African Miles.
Oh, that was a bit of a disaster after
Funk
Monk.
Yeah, Funk Monk, Electric Ellington. So it was always this sort of, you know, let's look at music in a different way. Let's just be in... I suppose you get to a point where you sort of, you don't want to be comfortable, too comfortable. Mm. you know, I'm involved with projects. For instance, I do a lot of Nigel Kennedy's work at orchestra and various different bands, and you're never quite comfortable there, as you can imagine. So this was always one where for the musicians, when we'd go into rehearsals or we'd sort of look at various sort of parts, it was always something where the musicians gave 500% rather than, oh, we're just playing notes.
Paul, let me ask you a little bit about that, because you get this band, a really impressive, you know, roster of musical talent together. I wonder, when you go back to the source material, even though it is a reimagining, a reinterpreting, does it make you listen to the original work in a different way once you get the insights, the different emotions that come from this current crop who, as Orphy says, are giving it, well, at least 500% by
the
sound of it?
Yes, at least.
I think, yeah, definitely. You, every time you listen to Love Supreme, you kind of hear something new anyway. And I think that... we looked at a lot of different recordings of Love Supreme. I mean, Alice Coltrane, John Coltrane's wife's version of Love Supreme is supremely different. And we incorporated that, you know, because she brought in words from her guru. She was a practicing Hindu. And that became part of the piece. And I think that was part of the idea with Love Supreme, was that the album itself is a very compact piece of music. And what we've done is kind of open it up to other spiritual traditions. So we brought in Alice's influence in terms of, you know, her Hindu beliefs. We've also brought in aspects of some of the work that Coltrane did towards the end of his life, where he played with Olatunji, who was a Nigerian Bata drummer, who probably would have believed in the Ifa religion, which is kind of, again, another essential kind of part of, I suppose, the Afro-diasporic musical tradition, you know. So we brought in a lot of these different elements to work with the original idea.
And Orphy, there's going to be a performance this week in London, but what's the journey of this piece of music? Are you hoping it's going to be an album? Are you hoping it's going... What do you want the life of this piece of music to be?
It's interesting you say that because, you know, I was thinking the other day, at the moment, I seem to be buying albums again that are on vinyl. I'd gone through a whole thing of, you know, CDs and digital and all of that, and I'm going back to vinyl. I love all that crackly surface noise. I love all of that. It's just a whole different listening. I think this would be a great recording to put out on vinyl, and I think Paul will sort of take that further.
We've had a little bit of interest from an audiophile label who've kind of popped up on the scene in recent times, and they've kind of taken on board some spiritual jazz aspects to go with their catalogue. Gearbox Records, who are two very interesting guys, and they've definitely expressed an interest in putting out the recording that we did of the concert at the Queen Elizabeth Hall.
So how many people do you need on stage to kind of pull this off then?
15.
Let me just ask you off a little bit about, because it sounds, you know, describing, Paul, there, like, you know, these different influences that you can draw in from across the ages. And there's an almost a sort of a sort of musical alchemy, turning one thing that people think they know into something else that can have this incredible lustre all of its own. Is anything off limits, do you think? Is there a piece of music that's so dear to you, you just think, I don't even want to reimagine that because it's too perfect the way it is? Or do you think actually you can always add a layer of something extra, almost whatever it is?
Right. That's interesting you say that. I've had that conversation to do with some Stevie Wonder albums for a friend of mine. And we were saying, could you ever do another version, you know, do a version of it? Or is it things that you just want to leave alone? There are things you just think, no, you're on hide into nothing there. I mean, I find with this that what I find interesting is because I'm conducting and I also bring in certain elements of conduction, which is generating music and textures and frequencies from musicians through hand signals. So I can extend sections, I can shorten sections, I can take them into other areas. So for me, it gives me a whole other perspective where, because it's being reimagined and re-envisioned as the basis of all of that, I can then take the musicians on a journey, as well as the audience, as well as myself, and hopefully.
So would you say it's
something
kind of liberating, rather than being restrictive? Like I'm working within people's expectations, and I'm working within what they already know.
That's
it's actually
right.
Quite a freeing experience.
Oh, it really is. It's a real sort of 360 rather than a 180. It's a real 360, sort of total football, like the Holland.
And a question to either of you. Bring us back to the very beginning where we started this discussion. Why was this piece of music at that time, 1964, I understand it was all recorded in one go. Why was it so important? Why did it surprise so many people?
I think that the story behind the actual recording of the album is very interesting. I mean, I think it was a time, 1964 was post the civil rights, the big civil rights demonstrations, you know, and the March on Washington. There was, you know, in a way, there was a sense of optimism at the time. But at the same time, there was, like there is in America today, you know, there's ongoing kind of conflict between the African-American community and the forces of those in power. And I think that, you know, there was a lot of disillusionment as well as a struggle going on at the time. Coltrane's Love Supreme was a spiritual piece. I mean, he basically had gone off to his house in Dix Hills, which I think is New Jersey. Yes. And he'd retired to a quiet part of the house and hadn't been seen for days, apparently. And he sort of came down to meet his wife, Alice Coltrane, with this piece of music. And he said, this is the first time I have ever written one piece of music all in one go. And that was, you know, it's a suite in four parts, very comprehensive. And that was what he took into the studio on December the 9th, which is the day that we're going to perform at the Union Chapel. And they went into Rudy Van Gelder's Blue Note Studios.
That's right. Yeah.
And cut that one section on that day. I mean, they did do other recordings. If you check out the deluxe edition of Love Supreme, you'll find Archie Shepp as well was involved in the recordings. And we took some of those things on board. But that's the whole thing around that album. And I think basically John Coltrane was one of these people, as Orfie said, who basically struggled to convey an energy, a spiritual energy, to the point where on the most recent recordings that have come out of his, he's virtually on stage beating his chest and screaming into the microphone to try and get the feeling that he wanted from the stage.
And did you manage to go to a quiet corner of your house and do the whole thing in a day? You're looking at me like, no way. That isn't easy.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing is that Roland Sutherland, who obviously has rewritten everything. Well, Roland is a real taskmaster. We both grew up in Stoke Newington, the strange guys, me playing xylophone, him playing flute, and all of that at a particular time where it was probably a lot cooler to be a guitarist or something. Yeah. You know, he's obviously gone off into the classical world and he's very successful there. But when he puts pen to paper, it's always really, really interesting. I can't get away with anything in rehearsals because he's immediately on my case. And that I like as well, because just because the exciting areas that he goes with his writing has always sort of fascinated me as well.
And so, he retired to a very quiet place. Yes, he did, in order to do the score.
He always retreats. Yeah.
I just want to ask you one final thing, perhaps. As you mentioned there, Paul, it's, you know, 50 years on December the 9th, 64. This is 2014, that's 50 years. You start to think of other great suites of music, great pieces that, you know, that maybe 2015, 2016, every year it seems like there's an amazing 50-year anniversary. Is this something we could look forward to, more reimaginings? Could you sort of be drawn back to your favourite pieces year on year on year? It's such an exciting notion, I guess.
I think it's possible. I think that one of the things is we constantly have a task of regenerating interest in the tradition, in the culture which has created what we are today. And I think that that's one of the most important things, is to actually look, for us to be able to look at what people have done in the past. And, you know, I suppose the whole thing about that kind of African-American jazz tradition, the spirit of improvisation, is something that you can invest in and build on.
Yes, that's very true. Obviously, you can look at incredible concerts and music that have been written by people like Duke Ellington, the sacred concerts, and things that, you know, could also be reimagined in various different ways as well. So there's a great, fantastic library of music out there to, you know, some where you just sort of reflect and listen to, and then some where you want to get in and involved. So we'll see what comes up.
That's Orfie Robinson, musical director of the A Love Supreme project, and Paul Bradshaw, the project's curator. Thank you both very much indeed for joining us here at Midori House.
Thank you very much.
For those of you who cannot make it to London's Union Chapel this coming Tuesday, the 50th anniversary of the recording of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme, let's hear a little of it now. This is some of a performance given on Midsummer's Night in 2012 at King's College Chapel at the University of Cambridge here in the UK.
A Love Supreme there, marking 50 years since John Coltrane's masterpiece was recorded. And don't forget, you can hear that live at London's Union Chapel this coming Tuesday at 7 p.m.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. Coming up next, we'll bring you a rare broadcast interview with one of Colombia's most celebrated novelists. Stay tuned.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like Hindbrook paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Andrew Tuck. In Bogota, in 1983, a young barman called Thomas Gonzalez wrote a book called In the Beginning Was the Sea, a story of deceit, a betrayal, and the fragility of love. The book was published in Spanish by the owner of the bar Gonzalez worked at the time, and quickly became one of the most celebrated works in Colombian literature.
Well, In the Beginning Was the Sea was this year published in English for the very first time by Pushkin Press. Thomas Gonzalez came to Midori House to discuss his defining work with Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound.
Thomas, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. And first of all, I love the book. It's an unusual book in the sense that 20 years after you wrote it, it comes out in its English translation. Talking about the novel now, for interviews such as this, does it feel like you're mining into a bit of your own past? Is it a memory of writing the book that comes back to you?
Yes, now I wrote it so many years ago that when I read it again, I cannot separate was fiction at the time of the events that really happened. So everything is becoming fiction or everything is becoming real now.
Is that a part of memory, that memory sort of fictionalizes things? It smooths the edges or sharpens edges?
I think so. I think memory always works that way. You construct your past. The real past is lost. You cannot, you have not access to it. The only thing you can do is to reconstruct it. So, and that reconstruction is a work of fiction.
The novel takes a linear, maybe it takes a year of a couple's life on this kind of, not exactly Treasure Island, is it? But it takes a year of this couple's life. I mean, it's done in quite a linear way, but you always feel that there is an expression boiling under the surface that I found I wanted the characters to talk more than they do. And that's a nice device of yours, that a lot of the interior life of the characters lives in the mind of the reader. Was that something you intended to do when you wrote it, Thomas?
Yes, I think so. And also my intention was to show how the jungle and the sea get into their interior lives, and the sea and the jungle start to erode their intimate personalities.
There's a bit of a, to use another metaphor from another well-known novel, certainly in English, there's a bit of a Lord of the Flies thing going on. You rolled your eyes when I said Treasure Island earlier, or you laughed at the suggestion that it was such a thing. But there's a bit of wildness, or a bit of the wilderness that comes in to inhabit the otherwise very sophisticated protagonists of your book, right? Is that one of the themes of the book, that you can't really escape the wilderness? It'll get you in the end.
Yeah, and talking about the Treasure Island, it is really a beautiful place, but they couldn't keep it. They couldn't even get there. But the thing is that they lost that treasure. They had it. They had possibility of living there, and they couldn't.
Do you think the treasure in the book is their relationship is what exists between them, or do you think it, for you, for the protagonists, I should say, that it is something that is the house?
The precious thing is the sea itself, the beauty of the region, the jungle, the trees, and they little by little lose everything, all of the of that beauty.
And is there, it seems, a reason that that it's not really down to their fault? I mean, they're kind of, they're passionate, they're angry, they argue, they fight, they make love, they're a young couple, mm-hmm. they're quite idealistic, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And I know that they're, you know, that they're quite sophisticated people, but they can't kind of, they can't beat the beast of maybe Mother Nature. I wanted to talk about the title of the book. We're familiar with the phrase, "In the beginning was the," from Genesis. Mm-hmm. The beginning was the Word. What are you saying with "in the beginning was the sea"? You sort of countering that? Are you trying to say that nature came first?
I found that that sentence in the Museo del Oro in Bogotá. Mm. It was in the wall, and it's part of the Kogi cosmology.
And there's a quote in the front of the novel, isn't there, that that uses that, the Kogi cosmology. Can you tell our listeners who they are and what the rough history of that?
I don't know much about them. They live in the northern mountains close to the sea, and the cosmology they have is very elaborate, but I didn't go deep into that. I just used...
just stole the phrase.
Only the phrase, and I tried to keep the book with that spirit.
So that's an interesting thing, to kind of write an entire novel, trying to be very focused on the meaning of one line. Was that one of your sort of novelistic, your writerly disciplines?
Yeah, I was very lucky to find that the phrase just a little bit after I started writing the novel. The fact that I found it gave me the direction that I had to give the book in order to keep it without that perspective, deep philosophical, cosmological perspective of these Indians from the Colombian mountains.
The book was first published in Colombia in 1983. And at that point in time, all over the West, you might say that there was a kind of back to the land movement. I think we're maybe living through something similar at the moment as well in certain societies. And this is what the protagonists, this is what Elena and Jay do in the beginning of Was the Sea. Is there a sense of it being a cautionary tale? Was it written as such, or did it end up as such?
I don't think so. I was trying to write what I thought that happened to my brother. Mm. I didn't have any other intention there than to try to understand what happened to my brother there.
And can you tell us about that? Because, I mean, I read and reviewed the book with a bit of internet research on what happened. But maybe you can tell us. I mean, as I say, the novel was published originally in Spanish in 1983. It's just come out in English, but there's obviously an interesting story behind it that hopefully doesn't ruin the book for people that know the story of why you wrote the book.
I don't think so. For me, the important thing is how it happened. And the fact that the reader know what is behind the book is not going to ruin it, because... the reader will have to see how it happened. And for me, it's the most important thing of writing him.
And I wonder, as a novelist yourself, and you used to work as a translator as well, right. I wonder if you can look at a text, and you can read a novel and not have any... Are you curious about the people that write novels? Because it's great for us to be able to interview the people that write the books we like I'm doing now. Are you interested in doing the same, or do you look at the words on the page purely as words on the page and they can exist sort of in their own universe?
I think they exist, they form its own universe, and that's the purpose of literature, not to recreate the world, but to create another world, another dimension of reality.
And finally, on the geography, I was interested in the geography of the book. Do you yearn for that part of the world? Do you think that part of the world, that part of Colombia, has changed a lot since you wrote the book? I wonder if there are hotels on that sort of treasure island, as we're going to call it for now.
I went there maybe 2 years ago, 1 year ago, and I found it almost the same.
Ah.
Hasn't changed at all. It's still very beautiful. But the tourism hasn't ruined it yet. There is a little tourism, but not a massive tourism. So The beauty is still there.
Okay. But there's a harsh beauty to it. It was a kind of place I wanted to be dropped in for 24 hours and then have the possibility of leaving. What do you think about it?
Yeah, it's not for a long, long... You don't want to live too long there. It's too much.
The sea will get you in the end, right?
I think so.
That was Tomas Gonzalez, author of In the Beginning Was the Sea, which has been translated into English for the first time, speaking to Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. Well, that's that, Andrew. The curtain falls on edition 283 of the Monocle Weekly. Of the 283, where would you place that one exactly? I want a specific number.
It's pretty much up there. It's in the 200s anyway.
Okay, that's lofty, relatively
speaking.
Well,
yeah, I'm a kind of hard taskmaster about these things, especially when a giant curtain's just fallen on my head.
Well, you've got to be careful about that. And I know also you're itching to hurry outside and greet those reindeer again, aren't you?
Do you want to know the pacing of the next 2 or 3 hours? So there's back outside, fondle a reindeer. Then, in no time, my little wheels will be down again, heading back out to the airport, because tomorrow we land in Tokyo for the last event in Tokyo of the year. And then we're going to be in Hong Kong on Wednesday for an event that we're doing with Cathay Pacific to promote the forecast. Oh, yes, the forecast. If you haven't got one by now.
You will not let that lie, Andrew. That's quite exciting. And it's been a trip, hasn't it? It's been a global extravaganza, I guess, with that.
Yes.
All points.
All points. And then, but then it's back home. And then we've got Christmas party coming up soon as well.
I'm girding myself for that right now.
I know. There's always one tragedy, which is glorious because you can live off it for the rest of the year. Hello, David Pleasant.
Generous in spirit, as always. What's David got up his sleeves this year? I can hardly wait. That is all we have time for edition 283. Let's issue some thanks, shall we, Andrew? To our producers. It was a little team, Thomas Lewis and Alice Block, and to our ever-present studio manager, Claire Urban. The Weekly's back the same time next week. I don't know who'll be in the hot seats, Andrew. I think it might be myself and Steve Bloomfield.
Yes, I don't think it's going to be me because me and Robert Bound will be on our way back from TYO.
Well, happy travels, and you, dear listeners, can join me and Steve next week. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards,
and me, Andrew Tuck,
it's goodbye.